damage to each of the towers and damage to surrounding areas, including to homes, businesses, and infrastructure. In addition to displacing thousands, the attacks destroyed civilian property worth millions of U.S. dollars, the human rights group said. 45-year-old computer engineer Nihad Abdullatif Taha, who had a programming and digital marketing company, Portals, described the devastation to HRW. I had 36 employees and we were renting two apartments, 360 square meters with furniture, offices, meeting rooms, surveillance cameras. All of this is gone, he said, adding, in addition to very important documents, all the company's papers are gone, including stamps, and the employees' contracts are gone. The new analysis also pushes back on the Israeli regime's military contention that groups use parts of any of the buildings for military research and development or military intelligence purposes. Human Rights Watch found no evidence that members of Palestinian groups involved in military operations had a current or long-term presence in any of the towers at a time they were attacked, the group said. What's more, even if there were such a presence, the attacks appear to cause foreseeably disproportionate harm to civilian property. Ware, in his statement, said reconstruction for Palestinians requires not just ending Israeli regime's repeated and ongoing attacks on Gaza, but termination of the blockade. Throughout the May hostilities, unlawful Israeli strikes not only killed many civilians, but also destroyed high-rise towers, wiping out scores of businesses and homes, upending the lives of thousands of Palestinians, Ware said. Donor funding alone will not rebuild Gaza, he said, adding, the crushing closure of the Gaza Strip needs to end, along with the impunity that fuels ongoing serious abuses. The Zionist regime's May attacks on Gaza has also come under the scrutiny of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, who said that they may constitute war crimes. Despite Israelis' claims that many of these buildings were hosting armed groups or being used for military purposes, she said in May, we have not seen evidence in this regard.
We get people.
Housing crisis in America.
The U.S. is facing a decade-long housing shortage. The government will have to build homes for dozens of years to tackle this issue. Home prices in almost every U.S. state have been on the rise over the past year with no end in sight.
Currently in the United States, we have a huge shortage of housing. We're not producing nearly as much housing as we should be.
We know that home ownership is the primary way of getting into the middle class, but unfortunately, there are many impediments to that that are divided by class and particularly race.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Daniel Arya. Now, as the Delta variant of the coronavirus spreads fast across America, people are still suffering to meet the basic needs of their families, including a place to stay. Tenants are naturally the most vulnerable in dealing with evictions. In this episode, we will delve into the housing crisis in America and how more painful it's become throughout this pandemic. Stay with us.
If you're looking to buy a home, the best thing you can do from a flood perspective is know what your current risk is from the current environment and then how that will evolve over the next 30 years. And flood risk isn't a static, one-time thing that you need to look at. It is an ever-evolving risk that continues to grow in some parts of the country at an exponential rate.
The economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic has hit America hard, with many people losing their jobs, particularly in the fast food industry, airlines, hotels, restaurants, and the service sector. Low-income families are struggling to make ends meet. Affordable housing is a key issue. The plight of tenants has escalated into a legal and political row about evictions.
You know, there are so many rental property owners, housing providers, who are independent rental owners. They're not large corporations. And when they don't receive rent, they still have to find a way to pay their mortgage for the property, to pay the water, the lights, to pay the insurance. There's been no relief for them on that particular front. And I can tell you some of our own stories. And in my company in Southern California, we do manage for independent rental owners. I have one client who owns 5 rental units. She has one renter who hasn't paid rent since April of last year and is now delinquent to the tune of $21,000.
The idea was that landlords are not allowed to evict their tenants throughout this pandemic, which has caused serious economic hurdles for many inside the United States. Our first guest today is economist Marcia Baker. Welcome to the show, madam. First off, what challenges is the nation facing today which emanate from the overarching issue of housing in America?
Americans have a housing challenge alongside a challenge of unreliable electricity, a very difficult transportation, food access, healthcare access, and with housing, there are 580,000 homeless by official count. And beyond that, the U.S. has the highest rate ever in the number of people per household. The old are staying with their younger children. You have 3 and 4 generations crammed together. So you have a crisis of living conditions and people being very upset and worried because they're one day from being out on the street. So the drug addiction problem, alcoholism problem, it all goes together in the housing crisis in the U.S. today.
Facing a deadly global pandemic, low-income families are finding it increasingly difficult to make ends meet. Struggling tenants are facing the threat of eviction from their landlords. Meanwhile, home builders and apartment associations have spent millions of dollars on lobbying for an end to the moratorium on rental evictions. As the ban expired on 31st of July, President Joe Biden reportedly froze housing lobbyists out of discussions with the White House, and he asked the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, to issue a renewed ban on evictions of tenants. The 60-day ban was duly issued.
Are you sure it's going to pass Supreme Court muster?
There are several key scholars who think that it may, and it's worth the effort.
His argument is that even if this move is ultimately blocked by the courts, at the very least, it will buy states time to distribute tens of billions of dollars in federal rent forgiveness to help make renters whole and keep them from being kicked out of their homes.
Yet, the fight over whether landlords should be allowed to evict their cash-strapped tenants has to be resolved in American courts. We're now joined by journalist Mike Harris for his insight into the matter.
Well, my pleasure.
Now, Mike, how come housing is still a problem in America today, considering the fact that the U.S. is spending huge amounts of money elsewhere in the world for military and intelligence purposes?
Well, one fundamental truth that the government of the United States has forgotten is that they are here to serve the people, and that truth has been lost. They're currently more involved with serving the special interest groups, namely the military-industrial complex, the big banking cartels, those people who are trying to consolidate and expand the U.S. empire. In fact, our government has in many cases turned toxic against the people of the United States and is doing things that are really prosecuting the U.S., the citizens of the U.S., and damaging them in many ways.
A CDC ban on evictions by landlords was introduced specifically to address the situation in counties with high levels of COVID-19 transmission. But the ban soon turned into a subject for political wrangling among politicians, and landlords soon rushed to put an end to it through through legal lobbying.
What I also understand is, what it's like to get an eviction notice.
Years ago, she lived out of her car while caring for a newborn and a toddler.
I know what it's like every single minute to not be able to sleep because you got two kids. You got to make sure that you keep safe.
It will be a win for people who have, for such a long time, because I'm one of those people. That's why I ran for office. Felt like nobody listened.
The CDC measure was supposedly meant to protect tenants who state under a penalty of perjury that they are unable to pay rent and would face overcrowded conditions if evicted. The measure in part triggered a fierce debate about the federal government's authority to do so. What is the situation like today, and what should be done about it?
The immediate situation in August in the United States regarding housing is there is an extension of preventing throwing people out of their houses until October. The institutions of the United States, the courts, the Supreme Court, the presidency has approved this, and this is a continuation of not evicting people that came in under President Trump during the pandemic in 2020. But there's no solution here. What is necessary is to freeze the rental agreements and the mortgage mortgage contracts, and sort them all out.
The House Democrats initially rushed to reverse course amid a serious divide between progressive lawmakers and the housing lobbyists. But after a short time, some Democrats fell in line with the lobbyists, putting the fate of evictions hanging in the balance. As the power struggle continues, nearly 45 million tenants in the United States are facing growing concerns about how to resist evictions by their landlords.
$50 billion was allocated, $46 billion. Less than 10% of that has been spent. Around $3 billion is reported to me, but let's say it would be 10%. Why should the renters be punished for the fact that the system did not put money in their pockets to pay the rent to the landlord? So that's where we come to this. It's like, well, CDC, you have defined this, and these people have not gotten the money. So this is, I think this is something that will work out. It isn't about any more money. The money is there, resting in localities and governor's offices across the country.
There are also more than half a million homeless people today, according to official estimates, who see no path to the right to have a home. The power play in Washington is indeed causing a great amount of human suffering as politicians continue partisanship in the hopes of gaining more control. So what role do you think that partisanship plays in the housing shortage and homelessness in America today?
The problem in America regarding leadership is we have conflicts between parties when above the parties we have to have the right policies. And you have Wall Street and London heavily represented in both parties that want to continue to have a bailout, want to speculate in housing, speculate in unregulated electricity, and worse, they want crazy green policies. So the solution to the housing and the rest of the lack of production in the United States that's currently the condition is above parties.
For decades, powerful housing industry groups have been lobbying politicians on Capitol Hill to influence policy. Take the most powerful one, the 100-year-old National Association of Realtors, or NAR, which has spent nearly $700 million on lobbying politicians since 1998.
I'm Charlie Lee, Senior Counsel and Director of Legal Affairs at NAR. As buyers compete in a hot real estate market, they are searching for ways to stand out from the crowd. One method being used is to send a love letter to entice the seller into choosing their offer. While a love letter may seem innocent, they can raise fair housing concerns and risk exposing both the real estate broker and their clients to legal risks.
It is no surprise that since the pandemic began, the association has been at the forefront of the legal fight to end the moratorium on rental evictions. But the association is not alone and has the backing of the U.S. Supreme Court, which bolstered the legal case against the ban by giving the Biden administration just 3 days to end prohibition of evictions. The ban on evictions had been initially imposed by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention last September.
The big firms like Vanguard and State Street and BlackRock have been buying real estate, residential real estate, at a prodigious rate and have been bidding up the prices. Well, they're going to crash those prices in conjunction with the eviction moratorium expiring. And so what this is going to do is going to have a catastrophic effect on all of real estate pricing. So real estate pricing in the U.S. is going to be cut 40, 50, 60, 70% in its current valuation. What this is going to do is the same situation they were in back in 2006, 7, and 8 when the mortgage crisis happened, and people could not refinance. They could not sell their homes for what they owed on them, and they were forced into foreclosure again.
The totality of the row over evictions sheds light on the depth of divide within the U.S. political system, with the Supreme Court, the Biden administration, and the CDC fighting to take the right decision. The American people appear to be the actual victims of inaction by U.S. authorities. American officials have indeed failed to ease circumstances for many.
You know, the lawsuit that the Southern California Rental Housing Association has filed in federal court has been denied, and we immediately filed an appeal. One might wonder why we would file an appeal on some legislation that's due to expire, quite frankly, today. But what we're seeing is this overabundance of legislation against rental housing providers and this pitting of renters versus rental housing providers. And we want it to stop.
Now, Americans have until October 3rd for the latest CDC moratorium to expire. The buildup of tensions among the poor is getting out of control, whereas realtor lobbyists brutally advance their agenda to give more power to landlords, who are the people promoting the idea of a return to evictions. How are they benefiting from evictions, and what is their ultimate goal?
The people who are promoting this are the banking cartel, run by the five or six too big to fail banks that were bailed out by the taxpayers in 2008. It's the same people. They're the ones who underwrite the loans. Those are the ones who make it possible. They're the ones who are going to benefit by taking possession of the wealth and property of the middle class. And what they're going to do is turn America from a home-owning society into a rental society, where the American dream of owning your own home will be gone. And they're doing this. This is part of their goal to asset strip. They're strip mining the American middle class and trying to steal all their wealth to remove what little wealth that the people of the United States currently enjoy.
Housing went on a historic run this year, despite the common assumption that it would sink in the wake of the economic recession caused by the coronavirus pandemic. But the housing market is seeing a major shift. As fewer properties are available in the market, the situation is triggering bidding wars across the country, and house prices are rising steadily.
There's a bidding war for literally every home on the market, every fixer-upper, every house that needs even a lot of work.
My neighbors, actually, because we're on vacation, were calling me and texting me saying, what is going on at your house? There's people in a line down the block. We saw two people having a fight.
Everybody expected housing to really sort of dry up.
The situation is convincing a significant portion of the population to immigrate, and one top destination would be across the Atlantic to Europe, according to statistics. Would-be home buyers are getting fed up by soaring prices, and they're lost out in bidding wars.
The underlying problem in the United States with housing, and the same with other physical and soft infrastructure like schools or manufacturing plants, is the physical production of housing and of manufacturing has not been expanding. You have not had the housing units built that you need, and worse than that, you've had decades of speculation in pre-existing housing, and you have the Wall Street London factor coming in on the situation making big profiteering off big mansions, while the ordinary worker families of the nation do not have adequate housing.
With prospects of owning a home becoming increasingly distant for many Americans, people are wondering where the housing market is headed to next. Many experts believe that house prices will continue to rise, and there is virtually no prospect of a significant fall in house prices in the near future. Meanwhile, homes are selling for up to 30% over asking price. Nationwide, houses are being sold for more than their original list price.
We know that that typically also requires having a certain amount of income. And for a lot of people, that is much easier said than done. For example, for people of color, it is much harder to be able to put down that type of down payment because they may not have the familiar support as people who come from more affluent neighborhoods.
These gaps are exceedingly troubling because the implications of them are very pervasive. Black household wealth is one-tenth what it is for white households, and a big, large portion of that gap is due to the lack of home ownership. Even though mortgage rates are at historic lows, there's been a ratcheting up of the qualifications that are required to borrow to become a homeowner, and that has impacted minority households more than majority households.
Of course, there is plenty of space and materials for building new homes. However, greater supply of new houses does not solve the problems of housing and homelessness in America, since these new homes remain unaffordable and out of reach for many.
You have to remember that 2006, 7, 8, when the Wall Street banking firms inflated the real estate bubble and intentionally burst it and dispossessed over 8 million households. And so that recovery has kind of happened. The people who were dispossessed still have not recovered fully. And so one of the reasons that we have such a homeless problem is because of that, because people lost everything. So you have a middle class that is struggling to hang on to what little it has left. And now we have our current crisis, this COVID issue.
The housing crisis, of course, was not caused by the pandemic, but only exacerbated by it. Back in 2018, the official statistics of the federal government showed some 35% of the people could be unsheltered across the states. People had no idea a global pandemic was about to break out.
The codes basically say if you have this kind of function going on within a building, in this kind of building, you can use these standards in order to meet our level of safety, sanitation, etc.
When you build in an area, one of the first things you do is you acquaint yourself with the exact code requirements that will affect the development and building process at that specific site. Then the specifics you also check against the code as you go.
Though we at FEMA are active in that process and engage in promoting these hazard-resistant building and fire codes, it is really down to the local level to adopt and implement those new codes and standards.
The insufficient construction of new housing units is indeed a deep-rooted issue in a country tagged developed. Now that is a serious challenge facing the Biden administration, which is expected to focus on the construction of affordable housing. Some also argue that there should be higher taxes on returns from real estate investments.
There is a range of people and firms that want to end the ban on evictions, and they range from a grandmother who lives on renting out half of her house to big institutions that are profiteering, pirate investment firms like BlackRock that set up a company to buy mass housing, or Warren Buffett. They have their interest in lifting the ban on evictions, plus many realtor associations. But you can't take one side, you have to get rid of this speculative side of this. We should not have speculation in a necessity of life, which is housing.
A persistent problem the Biden administration must address is housing discrimination. Housing discrimination originates from discriminatory regulations deeply embedded within the U.S. law. For example, the practice of redlining black neighborhoods, denying African Americans credit to buy homes, has left deep scars in communities up and down the United States. Black Americans are still regularly and disproportionately targeted by predatory lenders and locked out of neighborhood opportunities. As a nation, America has not invested enough political will or dollars to bring about an equitable and affordable housing market for all of its population. The Biden administration has voiced its desire to increase the supply of affordable housing through tax credits. Yet, it remains far from clear whether this strategy will be effective in either the short term or the long term.
When you look at inequality in the United States of America, you have to start with housing. Where you put your head at night determines so many things about your life. It determines where your kids go to school. It determines the air you breathe, where you shop, how long it takes you to get to work. What we've seen in California is, as a result of policy, we have millions too few housing units. And that affects everybody in California. It starts with a homeless crisis that goes all through the state, but it also includes skyrocketing rents that affect every single working person in the state of California.
Now, having a shelter is, of course, not a privilege, but a right for every living individual. Apart from the housing crisis at a higher level, there are approximately 17 people experiencing homelessness for every 10,000 people in the general population with no hope of achieving the right to have a home. Well, that was our show, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Please tune in next week when we come back together for another episode of We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States was involved in Afghanistan long before 9/11, paving the way for its own defeat. The fall of Kabul, like the fall of Saigon in April 1975, demonstrates again that imperialism often doesn't work, even to meet the goals of the imperial power. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Zoltan Grossman, writer. This article is published under the heading, 5 Ways U.S. Created and Prolonged Afghan Crisis. Stay tuned For the details of this article, please. Media coverage of the Taliban takeover of Kabul would lead most Americans to believe that U.S. involvement in Afghanistan began after 9/11, with the invasion launched to topple the previous Taliban government. But Afghanistan has been at war continuously for 42 years, and the Pentagon has been involved every step of the way under both Republican and Democratic administrations. Far from standing in the way of a takeover, a series of U.S. interventions helped create, arm, and facilitate the Mujahideen that took the country away from more secular direction it had been taken in 1960s to 1980s. What Afghanistan has in common with both Vietnam and Iraq is its long history of resistance to foreign occupiers, long before the Americans ever arrived. This resistance to foreign rule is the only factor that has united Afghanistan's diverse ethnic and sectarian groups in the past two centuries. The fall of Kabul recently, like the fall of Saigon in April 1975, demonstrates again that imperialism often doesn't work, even to meet the goals of the imperial power. Imperial forces get lured into battle and then get bogged down in a quagmire they cannot win. British troops barely escaped with their lives from three colonial wars in Afghanistan before their global empire finally collapsed. The Russians withdrew in defeat in 1989, only a few years before the Soviet Union and its Afghan allies collapsed. And now the Americans have followed down the same path of imperial hubris and defeat. After the Reagan administration took power in 1981, it openly supplied weapons, including Stinger missiles, to the Mujahideen, who at that time were also assisted by a Saudi engineer named Osama bin Laden. American popular culture lionized the Mujahideen as anti-communist freedom fighters in movies such as Rambo III and Red Dawn. By openly backing the Mujahideen against the Soviets, the Carter and Reagan administrations helped set into motion a cycle of violence that has since claimed more than 2 million Afghan lives and thousands of American lives, and helped to create the Taliban. U.S.-backed rulers restricted women's rights before the Taliban existed. The first fall of Kabul to insurgents in 1992 marked the end of Afghanistan's secular era. The first severe restrictions on women's rights were instituted then not by the Taliban, which had not been yet formed, but by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen, who seized power from the pro-Soviet government. The Pentagon and CIA armed and financed the same vicious militia warlords who brought fundamentalist misogyny to Kabul in the first place. According to Amnesty International, the rape of women by armed guards appeared to be condoned by leaders as a method of intimidating vanquished populations and of rewarding soldiers. And Mujahideen were reported to have stopped women from working outside their homes or from attending health and family planning courses. Educated women, particularly working in the fields of education and welfare, were repeatedly threatened. the U.S. war has been a humanitarian catastrophe. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S.-backed Afghan government has killed many civilians in air strikes and still failed to prosecute senior officials responsible for sexual assault, torture, and killing civilians. Taliban fighters continue to abuse human rights and commit atrocities in their areas of control, which steadily grew throughout the years despite the 300,000-strong Afghan National Army, U.S. airstrikes, and more than $1 trillion spent on military aid and nation-building assistance. In its 20th century wars, the Pentagon always planned to leave behind Afghan and Iraqi proxy forces that would take up the fight, much as it tried to do through Vietnamization in 1973-75, and as Moscow tried to do just as unsuccessfully in Afghanistan in 1989-92. The third fall of Kabul, like the fall of Saigon, occurred in 2021 because the U.S.-backed army fell apart. A puppet government that is denied armed foreign backing can expire much like a terminal patient taken off of life support. As both Brzezinski and bin Laden understood, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires, where they could most effectively trap and defeat their foes. Propping up colonial puppet regimes only highlights their indebtedness of foreign masters and helps legitimize and strengthen insurgencies rather than weaken them. Bombing civilians and ignoring the suffering of the poor only drives them into the hands of the insurgents. As in other regions of Asia and Africa, fundamentalism and foreign occupation are two sides of the same coin. They reinforce each other, feed off each other, and need each other. But two wrongs don't make a right.
Ministry.
Minutes after the speech of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah ended on the 10th of Muharram, in which he announced the sailing of the Iranian ship loaded with diesel to Beirut, hysteria began in U.S. and Arab-funded media outlets, which considered the ship's arrival a declaration of war. One U.S.-funded MTV news outlet in Lebanon considered that the Iranian fuel ship fell like a cluster bomb and recalled the kidnapping of the Israeli soldier in July 2006, which, according to said outlet, caused a devastating war. The American ambassador in Beirut, Dorothy Shia, jumped on the first media wagon it could find on the Saudi Al Arabiya channel, blatantly responding to Hezbollah's decision to help the Lebanese people with Iranian fuel. I'm still struggling to understand as to under which law or right does this foreign ambassador have the audacity to even comment on Lebanese internal matters. But let us get to the point here. The U.S. ambassador declared that Lebanon does not need Iran's gasoline and that the U.S. has, wait for it, cleaner plans. I am currently shooting in a studio that is buying fuel three times the official price only to secure enough power to do our job in a country where the last time we ever had power grid electricity was some 3 weeks ago. Yet the U.S. ambassador thinks we do not need any gasoline only because we are getting it from our ally and friend, Iran. It took only one sentence by Sayyid Nasrallah. Iranian oil is on its way, and all hell broke loose. Western and regional countries scrambled to ask to be allowed to help us and provide us with gas, oil, and electricity with soft and deferred loans with incredible facilities. President Michel Aoun received a phone call from the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Chia, who informed him that she was informed by a decision by the U.S. administration to help Lebanon extract electricity from Jordan through Syria. Yeah, you heard that right, through Syria. Never mind the Americans' illegal imposed seizures act, nor the fact that there is zero diplomatic relation between Damascus and Washington, yet Chia throws in this option only due to confusion at Saeed Nasrallah's announcement. It does not end here. During her call with the president, U.S. Ambassador Chia pointed out that the American side is making a great effort to help Lebanon and that negotiations are underway with the World Bank to secure financing for Egyptian gas for Lebanon to repair and strengthen electricity transmission lines and the required maintenance of gas pipelines, which are again located inside Syria. I just have one question here. Who delegated Chia to do all of these issues? And then she has the audacity to call the Lebanese president and tell him what solutions he should be accepting or refusing while his nation suffers the most severe economic crisis since its independence? Wow. Just wow. It is astonishing how she has suddenly contrived high morals and dedication to help Lebanon. Her intentions are crystal clear, but it's too late. Nothing will be able to block the way for Hezbollah's effort to rid its people from humiliation and despair. The first Iranian fuel ship is on its way, and several others will only follow very soon. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. A ship for oil derivatives is headed to Lebanon from Iran, but its arrival in Lebanon will go beyond improving the conditions of the Lebanese. It will be the first ship to ever break the fuel blockade and will establish a new deterrence equation at sea this time. Lebanon's enemies are aware of its urgent need for energy. They stand behind a large part of its crisis, whether through sieges and sanctions or through obstruction and obstacles to solutions by proxy. The Lebanese crisis is no longer bearable. When hospitals in Lebanon stop working due to the loss of electricity and the lives of the Lebanese are at risk, and when a number of them die while in queues in front of the gas stations, and when bakeries operate at minimum capacity, intervention to help becomes a national duty, even a moral imperative. This is exactly what Hezbollah did. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maarouf, political commentator and senior media consultant. Thank you, Laith, for being with us. Now, some local and a lot of regional media as well considered the Iranian fuel ship on its way to Beirut at the moment as a cluster bomb, which could cause, again, a devastating war, forming a forefront of opposition against this Iranian fuel ship before it even arrives and just intimidating the public with warnings of possible hysterical outcomes. Do they have valid reasons for all of this concern?
Well, definitely it is a possibility that apartheid Israel, the United States, and its vessels in the Gulf will attempt to stop this ship from reaching Lebanon. But it's a very small possibility because we've seen a few months ago during the Sword of Jerusalem war in Palestine that apartheid Israel can't even take on the small resistance groups blockaded inside Gaza. And as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, has indicated, he said that the ship right now is considered a Lebanese territory and that anyone who will basically attack this ship will receive the same kind of retaliation. So we should be calculating that into what had happened also in the last few weeks in Afghanistan and the humiliating American withdrawal. So it is a very small possibility that apartheid Israel or the United States will open a battle with Hezbollah that they don't even know where it will end. They have avoided a direct war with Hezbollah over the last 10 years, 15 years since the end of the 2006 year war, and it's a very small possibility that they will do such a crazy move.
But something truly dangerous happened after Sayyid Nasrallah's announcement and declaration there, Laith. One local reporter suggested that a return to Resolution 1701 was a must and called for, quote, joint operations rooms, unquote, between the Lebanese army and the United Nations be used to intercept the Iranian ship. This is a call for war there, claiming it threatens the outbreak of war. So certain media outlets are calling for war to supposedly stop an act of war, which does not even make any sense here. Clearly, such calls are the U.S.'s first and foremost demand. I'm not making this up. This is what the ambassador herself is saying. Why is it that the U.S. wants to see a war in Lebanon? Who benefits if the country goes there?
Well, as was very apparent since 2006, apartheid Israel, the United States, and outside forces outside Lebanon cannot engage Hezbollah in a direct military confrontation. So it's been since that year that they have been searching for local actors to start a civil war. And as we heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's speech on Sunday, those who have the ability to start a civil war in Lebanon, and he was speaking about the Sunni leadership, some of the Sunni leadership, do not want a civil war. And those who want a civil war, like the Christian supremacist parties, they can't afford or cannot achieve a war. So therefore, what we have seen right now is there has been an economic war on Lebanon since 2019. And up until now, the goals that the United States set for this economic war, which is to instigate a revolt in the population against the presence of resistance groups in Lebanon, has not came to fruition. Most of the Lebanese people have absorbed all these shocks and awes of economic destabilization and have not revolted against Hezbollah and the resistance. And in fact, what Sayyid Nasrallah and Hezbollah have just done with this bringing and on the way this tanker with the oil products is making those who were standing on the fence jump to the side.
Immediately after Sayyid Nasrallah's speech, there was a phone call between U.S. Ambassador Dorothy Shea and the Lebanese President Michel Aoun. And Dorothy informed him, look at the words, she informed him that the U.S. administration wants to help Lebanon extract power, electricity from Jordan through Syria. Mind you, that's the same Syria that the U.S. has imposed illegal Caesars Act against it. So anyone who deals with the Syrian government or with any Syrian company, that is, will be put under those sanctions and suffer. How on earth is Shia planning to do so? I mean, there is zero diplomacy between the U.S. and Damascus here, and the U.S. had already imposed Caesar's Act upon Syria. How are they going to make that happen?
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, she is offering the moon and the sun the day after Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah announces the bringing the ship on the way with these huge projects of connecting the electric grid from Jordan to Syria to Lebanon, connecting the gas pipelines from Egypt to Jordan to Syria to Lebanon. Again, huge projects that will take 6 months to a year. That is, if there is
and
any
that will
objections.
Cost millions and millions of dollars that Lebanon does not have.
Exactly, and she said that she's speaking to the IMF to fund this project. So,
oh, thank you. More debt, yes, please.
Exactly, and what's funny about it, and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in his speech on Sunday pointed out, is that this shows that there was governments, because this project has been talked about for years, Jordan and Egypt, that were willing to help Lebanon, but the United States has been vetoing such a project. So what needs to happen is that the United States lifts its veto on cooperation between countries in the region and allow the Lebanese economy to integrate with the countries around it, which it should be. And the only obstacle in the way is American interference and veto. So Ambassador Shea basically exposed herself by saying that she's willing to do this project.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, look, like we will talk more about this in the second segment and talk more about how this Iranian ship will be an actual lifeline for all Lebanese people after this break.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
It became necessary for the U.S. to make Hezbollah pay the price of the strategic role it had played in preventing the fall of Syria and striking the strategic structure of the Takfiri groups in Iraq as well. Added to that, Hezbollah's extended hand to the Yemeni brothers, who are facing a colonial legacy that is more than 100 years old. Above all, Hezbollah's role in uniting the resistance forces in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Now, today, the Americans, along with France, Britain, and Germany, in cooperation with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, are using their old Lebanese tricks, which are political parties, feudal leaders, religious leaders, and academic institutions, and the new ones, civil activism institutions and NGOs, in an effort to attain one goal, implementing the strategy of tension with maximum pressure against Hezbollah and therefore against Lebanon. Iranian fuel lifeline for Lebanon in this following report.
"They will just get used to it," is a phrase attributed to Central Bank Governor Riyad Salemi commenting on the Lebanese people's dealing with the collapse of the value of their lira has sadly become the constitution of the majority of the power forces in Lebanon. 2 years ago, Lebanon went through three major economic shocks. The shock of the bankruptcy of the banking sector, which is reluctant to declare its bankruptcy, the shock of the collapse of the Lebanese lira and then lifting subsidies, and the shock of the power and fuel outages across the country. Each of these shocks is enough on its own to destroy an economy, even if it is a strong one, and to destroy the population's livelihood capabilities. The lifting of subsidies cannot take place, even in the most brutal capitalist systems, without a social safety net. Even the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and other institutions of the capital system in the world recommend that the decision to eliminate subsidies for basic commodities be simultaneous with social protection programs for the most vulnerable classes. Successive shocks that hit the population of Lebanon, coupled with the global pandemic of corona, the explosion of the port, and a continuous political crisis which produced irregularities in the constitutional institutions, like government vacuum, presidential vacuum, and parliamentary extension, that consumed more than half of the past 16 years. The reality is more like an undeclared war. In this regard, unconventional solutions must be found, foremost of which is securing energy sources in the face of monopoly and siege, and bypassing the complete impotence of institutions. Emergency procedures aimed at resuscitating the patient and preventing his death. Here lies the importance of importing oil from Iran. It is not a solution to the crisis in Lebanon, but it is certainly a lifeline in the face of the internal and external forces of death. Importing oil from Iran is neither a challenge nor an internal competition. Rather, it provides oxygen to Lebanon at a moment when many wants it to be completely strangled. Lebanon has many emergency options which the authority could have resorted to mitigate the severity of the collapse, in parallel with working on a reform plan that would halt the collapse and rebuild the system in an effective manner. Common sense says that the state should arm itself with the decision of the resistance and rely on it to impose alternative economic options that support the living capabilities of the population. However, the reaction of Washington and those in its orbit indicate a confrontation that they want the people to pay to push them back from their pro-resistance stance. Opening a fuel lifeline from Tehran to Beirut to import gasoline and diesel will produce effects that will mitigate the consequences of the crisis. Even if it does not constitute a comprehensive solution to it, it is the first attempt in Lebanese history to break the power of cartels and greedy importers, as well as a first break of the American decision to increase pressure on Lebanon.
Now we continue from Beirut with Laith Maarouf, political commentator and senior media consultant. Laith, the United States decided to fight all battles to prevent Hezbollah's plans to lift its people and with it the entire country, by the way, from the grip of all sorts of cartels, notably the fuel cartels and the pharmaceutical cartels, including preventing oil support from Tehran to reach Lebanon. Whether it is by sea, by land, by any means, they just don't want to see that help coming to the Lebanese people. What do you think will happen if Shia actually succeeds in pushing the Lebanese government into banning the Iranian ship from entering Lebanese waters?
Look, it is a very big if, because as we have seen, the major parties that are in power in Lebanon that are allied with Hezbollah, that control the majority in the parliament, control the president's office, are actually welcoming the arrival of this tanker. So what we would, the only way that this could happen is if there's a coup by the military, the Lebanese army, against the president and the parliament and against Hezbollah.
That's very dangerous.
And that's very dangerous. And we know that the United States has been pushing towards this confrontation between the military of Lebanon and Hezbollah, and they haven't had the success yet. And I doubt that even if General Aoun, in charge of the military, decides to follow the dictates of the United States, I doubt his soldiers will follow him. And that's because the actual composition of the Lebanese army is a reflection of the population of Lebanon, and that means that the majority of his own soldiers will refuse him. So this is a big if, and sanctions might be waived as a weapon against everybody in this country, and this is the last weapon that's left at the table of the United States to sanction the politicians of Lebanon as a whole, the whole government. And that will just drop everybody in the resistance basket, basically, and nobody will be affected by anything beyond that, any control of the United States. So it's a double-edged sword for the United States to threaten, number one, that the military take on Hezbollah and this tanker coming from Iran, and or to sanction the whole political elite in Lebanon, because then it will have zero influence over that situation on the ground.
Well, we have all these anti-resistance parties, like the regimes and governments all across the region and the world as well, working according to one theory. The defeat of Hezbollah now requires two things. One, to disband its allies, that's through sanctions, whatever the cost is, and then create tensions resulting from the living crisis that Lebanon is passing through, wherever they are and at whatever the cost as well. Tension is very easy to create in a country like Lebanon. We could just start a fight right now at the gas station outside this studio where people are gathering to try and get gasoline. But what will the U.S. be able, or how will the U.S. be able to disband Hezbollah's main allies in Lebanon? And if so, do you think that maybe the first party to fall from this alliance would be which one here? Do you have one in mind?
I personally think that the parties that are aligned with Hezbollah have taken a decision to be loyal, and Hezbollah has shown its loyalty no matter how much under pressure it came, because Hezbollah is the only party that has no corruption at all that anybody can point at. Right now, the biggest worry that we should look at here is not that some people will have a fight at a gas station or outside a bakery. The problem that we should be all worried about is the entry of an external power into the battle here. And this is, we look at the last 15 years, and we know that the major players that could have a civil war with Hezbollah are not capable of doing such. Therefore, the only thing that we should be worried about is the possibility of an external war.
Well, evident to your words here, Laith, just last week there was a trending on social media in Lebanon where a lot of the anti-resistance people who maybe support the Lebanese forces, the Jaja, political affiliated forces, they were calling through social media for the intervention of the NATO and foreign forces to rid them from what they are calling the Iranian occupation. This is beyond what one can believe, but it did happen. So you can actually feel how much of the investments of the U.S. embassy are taking their toll on the Lebanese society. Yes, there were not that high. I mean, you could study the trends in Lebanon, but at the same time, it was being used in English language, and they all were using specific words like